It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, the Wisconsin Innocence Project has just launched a new initiative aimed at wrongfully convicted Latino men and women. We'll find out why there's a need for that focus.
First, just days after Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump laid out his economic plan, his Democratic opponent Hillary Clinton gave an economic speech of her own today from the same city, no less. Here's Clinton from earlier today.
There is too much inequality, too little upward mobility. It is just too hard to get ahead today. But there are common sense things that your government could do that would give Americans more opportunities to succeed.
In the speech, she touched on her plans for taxes, job creation, and trade, among other things, and took several jabs at her opponent, who she says is out of touch with the middle class. So what did we learn today about Clinton's policies, and what questions are still out there?
Here with us now to talk more about Hillary Clinton's economic plan is Ross Levine. He's a professor of economics and the Willis H. Booth Chair in Banking and Finance at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. Ross, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, do you see this speech more as actually presenting Hillary Clinton's policies or more of targeting what Donald Trump had to say earlier, or a mix of both?
Oh, she did the both. She was able to advertise her own plans and spend a large component criticizing Trump's plan and using those differences to explain to people why she thought her plan is better than Trump's plan.
Both candidates speaking in Detroit this week. What do you make of that choice of venue for the economic policy speeches?
I think the one thing that's been clear throughout the presidential primaries and now the presidential elections is that there's a large group of people in the U.S. that have suffered from globalization and technological improvements. And Detroit, the car industry area, is an area that has suffered intensively, and so both candidates going there and giving a talk about how their policies are going to help middle-class America seems very appropriate.
On that note, Clinton spoke at a manufacturing and engineering firm. She talked about what she sees as a coming manufacturing renaissance in America. Here's another listen to her.
What's happening here can happen in so many places if we put our minds to it. If we support advanced manufacturing, if we are the kind of country that once again understands how important it is to build things. We are builders, and we need to get back to building.
Ross, is a new wave of manufacturing a realistic expectation in our near midterm future?
Sort of. Manufacturing in the U.S. can be very successful and compete internationally, especially when it involves the building of high-tech products, which is the business that candidate Clinton was standing in front of, and involves very high-skilled, highly trained workers. I think in other areas, the U.S. is likely to be less competitive internationally. But in that type of an arena, the U.S. manufacturers can be very successful.
What, in terms of government policy, have you been hearing from Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, for that matter, that might help or hinder that kind of job creation?
So from Trump, the strategy is to cut taxes on businesses, to cut taxes on the wealthy, and to encourage businesses and the wealthy to invest in a whole range of enterprises that will boost demand for workers and therefore create opportunities. For Senator Clinton, the strategy is more to provide free college education and provide a very large infrastructure project to put people to work, and also a strategy for providing tax breaks to small businesses and seed money to entrepreneurs to start their businesses. So two very different types of approaches.
Talking to Ross Levine from the University of California, Berkeley, looking at Hillary Clinton's economic speech in Detroit earlier today. Donald Trump spoke there on the economy and jobs as well earlier this week, back on Monday. Now, you were quoted on the issue of how Hillary Clinton deals with Wall Street. A lot of rhetoric within her own party, especially from the Bernie Sanders campaign, targeting Wall Street. She's had support, as her critics have pointed out, from people on Wall Street. How does she walk that line?
I think she has a very difficult time walking the line because she does have a long history of connections, both speaking to Wall Street and being the senator from New York, close ties to Wall Street. And at the same time, there's a big movement, certainly within the Democratic Party, but I think more generally in the Republican Party as well, people who are wary of Wall Street, critical of Wall Street's role in creating the Great Recession, and a feeling that many leaders on Wall Street didn't pay their fair share or weren't held accountable for their role in the crisis. So she's both embracing a broad set of policies to appeal to those who are wary of Wall Street, and at the same time not providing tremendous details, which will allow for a lot of interpretation later if she were to become president about which rules will be adopted and how they will be interpreted and implemented.
Is she adopting anti-Wall Street rhetoric that might appeal to the Bernie Sanders wing of her party?
Yes. She talks about holding executives accountable, about strengthening Dodd-Frank, about putting greater limits on risk-taking, about making executives accountable in a criminal context for the actions of their subordinates. And all of these are designed to appeal to Bernie Sanders followers and I think many others as well.
A big issue this year on the campaign trail in both parties is trade, free trade agreements. Here's Clinton again talking today about free trade.
My message to every worker in Michigan and across America is this. I will stop any trade deal that kills jobs or holds down wages, including the Trans-Pacific Partnership.
That seems to allow some wiggle room there, if the caveat is we're going to say if it's holding down wages, preventing job creation in the United States, if it could be renegotiated and tweaked where somebody could say, well, it's not going to do that now. How much wiggle room did she leave herself there?
I think on trade, Senator Clinton has been very good at leaving herself a lot of wiggle room. She has in the past been for the TPP and for NAFTA, and then over time expressed greater wariness of both. I think that the crucial issue is that there have been a movement toward openness to free trade over the last few decades, and the promise is always that the economic pie will get bigger, and the economic pie did get bigger. But the other promise of international trade is that there are going to be some losers. And part of the anger that's been expressed in the Democratic and the Republican primaries and continues to be expressed is that the society as a whole has not taken care of the people that have lost out from free trade, even though the benefits overall have been enormous.
There's been criticism of President Obama from within his own party, from Democrats and of Hillary Clinton for not doing more to take care of people who do lose out in this country. The factories that shut down in part maybe because of easier free trade. Is there any movement to change current agreements or honor the existing parts of agreements to do that?
It's going to be difficult. I think that it's unlikely that the changes would take place in the trade agreements, that what has to take place is in domestic policies in the U.S. Openness to trade means that the U.S. is going to be able to do what it does best, and other countries are going to be able to do what they do best, and so this is going to increase the pie. But for those people who are losing out in the U.S. has to adopt policies that help them and help their kids share and the growing economic pie. And that has not been as successful as it should have been over the last few decades.
A lot of the talk in this political campaign has been about things like Hillary Clinton's ongoing saga of emails and Donald Trump's ongoing saga of saying things that generate a huge backlash. Do you think in these speeches this week and the reaction to it, we're actually getting some productive discussion of an important policy issue?
Much more productive. It's clear. If you go and you look at Trump's policy and Clinton's policy, these are very different approaches to and very different strategies about how to push the economy forward.
Ross, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Ross Levine. He's a professor of economics at the University of California, Berkeley. He joined us to talk about Hillary Clinton's economic proposals, which she laid out in a speech earlier today.
A few cases that may involve wrongful convictions have recently gotten a lot of attention. The Adnan Syed case that was the subject of the first season of the podcast Serial is one example, as is the Wisconsin case of Stephen Avery, which was documented in the Netflix series Making a Murderer.
But there are a lot of possible cases of wrongful conviction that never get public attention or legal support. And many of the people who are incarcerated for crimes that they may not have committed have no resources to contest their sentence.
The Wisconsin Innocence Project has been able to help many wrongfully convicted inmates, and a new program is aimed specifically at helping Latino men and women get their cases retried. Christina Bourdais joins us in the studio now. She's director of the Latino Exoneration Initiative. Christina, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me here.
For people who aren't familiar with it, can you explain the mission and the work of the Innocence Project?
Well, the Wisconsin Innocence Project is a clinical program in the University of Wisconsin Law School in Madison. We work with students who are second-year students going between first and second year on cases. Our mission, obviously, is to exonerate people who are innocent, but it's also to teach law students how to work on these cases, to teach them the causes of wrongful convictions, and then to try to offer remedies for the criminal justice system to address the causes of wrongful conviction and prevent these from happening.
And what are some of those most common factors involved in wrongful convictions?
Well, there's a number of factors. The National Registry of Exonerations, which is a registry that the University of Michigan keeps of all people who are exonerated, kind of tracks those factors by cases. But the basic five factors that they've identified are false confessions is one big factor, mistaken eyewitness identification, flawed forensic science, also police or official misconduct is another one, and then perjury by informants or witnesses.
So what do we know about the racial and gender demographics of people who have been found to be wrongfully convicted? Are there particular groups that are overrepresented for their percentage in the population?
Well, there are groups that are underrepresented, which is actually the reason for Latino Exoneration Initiative. When you look at those numbers in the National Registry of Exonerations, you'll see that about 11% of exonerees are Hispanic. And yet, the number of Hispanics in the prison population, it's hard to tell exactly because actually a lot of times Hispanics are classified as Caucasian in the prison population. But from the numbers that are available, it seems like 21% of the prison population is Latino. So it's about half of what you would expect among exonerees. Whereas when you look at the number of African Americans and Caucasians, it's much more equivalent to their numbers. So that hovers somewhere around the 40 percentile for both of them. So it was on the basis of that that we started the Latino Exoneration Initiative. We applied to the Department of Justice for a grant explaining that we thought there was this disparity in the numbers, that we thought it was a function of lack of outreach and lack of expertise on working on these cases. And we were awarded a grant for a two-year program to address this problem and to try to reach out specifically to Latino communities.
And is that disparity between the number of Latinos who are incarcerated and the number that are exonerated, is that just in Wisconsin or is that a national trend?
That's national trend. Those are numbers of the National Registry of Exoneration that keeps numbers for all of the country. So there's about 1,800 people that have been exonerated thus far, a little bit more.
We're talking with Christina Bourdais. She's director of the Latino Exoneration Initiative, a new program of the Wisconsin Innocence Project. We know that African Americans are incarcerated at disproportionately high rates in Wisconsin. Is that also true for Latinos?
We believe so from the numbers that we can see. Like I said, it's hard to track, and we've found that looking right now at the Department of Corrections, a lot of the people that we know are Latino, they're classified as Caucasian. So it's hard to actually get hard numbers and get that answer. But we believe that is part of the issue.
So you talked about the five issues or conditions that are often in place or the cause of wrongful convictions in general. Are there particular issues that might lead to Latinos and Latinas being wrongfully convicted at higher rates?
I'm glad you asked that question because that's actually part of the reason for our initiative. We think that it's not only a problem of lack of outreach to this community, but also perhaps a lack of recognition of the particular issues that might arise in these cases. So obviously, there are more likely to be problems with interpretation, for example. But often, there are subtle problems with interpretation. It's not so much that a defendant doesn't get an interpreter, but that the interpreter might not be qualified. In many places, there isn't a requirement that the interpreter be certified. And then there's also questions about what it means for an interpreter to be certified, whether they are really meeting a high standard. Also, we've seen in many of our cases that our clients do speak English, and because they speak English, they try to get by in English, and yet they're not as articulate, and they have a harder time sort of expressing themselves and telling the whole story when they're speaking English. And then we've seen our clients also penalized because they asked for an interpreter. So we have one case, for example, where the judge said that our client was manipulating the system by asking for an interpreter, because he could tell that the client clearly spoke English. And obviously that client did understand some English, and he was trying to understand and answer the questions as much as he could, but he was not as comfortable, and that's why he wanted an interpreter. I've interviewed jurors who've told me that the client, that the defendant they saw on the stand was lying about not speaking English because they saw the person answering the question before the interpreter interpreted the whole question, which again was a lot of times people who speak some English, not a lot of non-native speakers might have spent a long time in the United States, and yet they'll ask for an interpreter because they feel more comfortable. So these are sort of subtler causes that can lead to wrongful conviction, that can lead to sort of biases creeping into the process, which are harder to catch and to see. And it's one of the things we want to do with our initiative, to be able to sort of focus on those issues and understand and have culturally competent staff. That's the other issue that comes about. Really, it's more than just speaking a language that you need. It's being able to understand the cultural issues that arise in these communities.
What about the issue of immigration status? How does that play in?
Immigration status, of course, is very much another issue, and we've already seen that in a lot of the cases that we're working on. A lot of witnesses are not willing to come forth. So we have, for example, some cases where our client will say, well, so-and-so could have been an alibi. And when you talk to that person, she'll say, well, I wasn't going to come forth because I'm documented.
And so they don't want to come into contact with the system.
With the system. And because people who are undocumented, who have come forth, for example, in that particular case that I'm talking about, there were serious consequences for this one person who did come forth. They put her in deportation proceedings. So other people did not want to come forth. So the immigration status is another reason that is in addition to all the reasons that exist in all cases for wrongful convictions, but that would be something more likely to occur in cases of Latinos that could lead to wrongful convictions. So our focus is on all those additional causes that might not be as well recognized and harder to spot.
I'm sure there have been Latino men and women who have been served well by the Innocence Projects nationally. Are there any of those stories that you could share with us?
Well, our first client, the first person the Wisconsin Innocence Project exonerated, was Chris Ochoa, who is a Hispanic man from Texas, who was exonerated by DNA evidence. And there were several racist things that were said in his case and that were problematic, that, you know, were part of the causes for wrongful conviction. So his was a case where he was convinced to give a false confession, and it was a long, detailed confession, but it turned out that a lot of it was something that was fed to him by the police officers. And when DNA testing was done on the victim, it was found that he was not, you know, as he then later claimed he was innocent, he was in fact innocent, and he was exonerated, and he then ended up going to the University of Wisconsin Law School, Madison right here, and getting a law degree, and he's now a lawyer.
One of the things that you mentioned is that there's a need for culturally competent people working on these cases, understanding the cultural milieu of the people they're serving. But it occurs to me, too, that one of the barriers might be people who are from another country really not understanding the U.S. legal system and not understanding that if you say something to a police officer, that might be used, or just how important certain steps of the process are.
My clients have difficulty understanding the criminal justice system, whether or not they're from this country. And as much as I try to explain it, it's baffling because if you do think about it, it's baffling even to people who are very well-versed. So it's that much more difficult for someone who comes from a different country to understand that. And I find myself repeating and explaining things again and again, and I'm a native Spanish speaker and I'll explain in Spanish, but it's just baffling to understand, why does it take so many years? Why, if he's innocent, is he still there? What is it that you need to show? Why can't that be enough? All these things are really difficult to explain. So it's that much more difficult. But also, just even understanding that there is a free attorney who can assist them is something that's very hard to understand or to even, you know, believe in some ways. I'm a native Spanish speaker. I grew up in Colombia, and when I moved to the States, to know that there were pro bono lawyers was just something I could never imagine. So I know that's part of the sort of translation that we need to do.
When you do identify a potential client, someone who may have been wrongfully convicted, how long a process is it for looking into the case, getting whatever additional testing, say DNA testing, you might need, or whatever, collecting witness statements? How long a process might it be before a case comes up to be retried?
Well, unfortunately, it's a very long process right now. Right now, in general, for the Wisconsin Innocence Project, we have about 200 people on the wait list. And at this point, it's taking us about 7 years to even get to their application, to even start the process of determining whether or not there's something that can be done. And identifying whether or not there's DNA in the case that can be tested is yet another part of it. So it's hard to give an average because it really is very case specific and it depends. But even in that beginning of the process, it's extremely long and we have very limited resources. So unfortunately, it's only getting longer.
And as we wrap up, Christina, where can someone get more information or apply to have their case considered?
Well, there's several places. They can go to our website, the Wisconsin Innocence Project, and there's an application they can download there. They can call our project, which the number is also on the website. For inmates who are in prison, there are applications in all of the law libraries, and they can obtain those applications for free.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Christina.
Thank you so much.
Christina Bourdais is director of the Latino Exoneration Initiative. It's a new program of the Wisconsin Innocence Project that looks to specifically identify and advocate for Latino men and women who have been wrongfully convicted.
When we talk about economic activity in the United States and around the world, we tend to look at things where money changes hands. Someone gets paid for goods or services.
But our next guest says there's another huge part of the economy hidden in plain sight. It's the world of unpaid work, things like child care, senior care, household maintenance, and more, often done by women. And she says when we overlook that kind of labor, we miss an important part of the way the world works and come up with misguided policies as a result.
Elizabeth Weingarten joins us now. She's director of the Global Gender Parity Initiative and senior fellow in the Better Life Lab at New America. Elizabeth, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on.
Well, what are we talking about when we talk about unpaid work?
So, you know, that is actually one of the most difficult questions to answer. It seems like it should be simple. But in fact, we did some research earlier this year with Politico Focus, and we found that even experts, people who are supposed to know all about unpaid work, all had very different definitions for what they thought unpaid work was. But, you know, the kind of basic definition that we tend to go with, kind of loosely defined, unpaid work is any type of activity or service that has a value in the marketplace. So, for example, spending time caring for your infant or taking care of an elderly family member, we would consider that to be unpaid work because technically you can pay a third party to do it. Of course, the problem is that a lot of people don't have that choice. But there's kind of an interesting way that one economist has described the distinction that we make between paid work and unpaid work, which is a country's GDP falls when a man marries his mate. So this is the kind of arbitrary distinction that we're talking about. But, you know, the people that we spoke to for the research, you know, some people thought when they heard the term unpaid work of homemaker, some people thought of the word slave, some people were thinking, you know, unpaid work is for interns. So there are lots of different definitions, but that kind of basic one of the activity or service that has some kind of market value is the one that is, I think, most people use today.
In a recent piece on the New America website, you argued that, or made the point that unpaid labor is in a lot of ways the foundation of what we traditionally see as our economy. How does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So at a very basic level, we don't have an economy without a workforce, right? And unpaid work is really what creates and nurtures our workforce. So I work at my job all week, and I'm only able to work at my job because my parents took the time to take care of me when I was a kid. You know, think about a woman with three kids who's an investment banker. She's doing her job because presumably somebody else is taking care of her kids. If she wasn't able to outsource that work, she would be at home taking care of them herself. So this is really the foundation for all economic activity because it's what creates and reproduces our the very workforce that we rely on for that activity.
Now, I imagine some people might push back at this concept of unpaid labor as something we'd need to measure, the sense that, well, we're monetizing something that we do out of love or out of obligation or responsibility to our family, whether that's taking care of a kid or maintaining the household or taking care of an aging relative. Is it still important, despite that we try to put numbers on it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we see that a lot, this kind of pushback, because, you know, people see childcare and elder care as activities that are somehow diminished by quantifying them or by valuing or measuring this work. And kind of what you were getting at, that by valuing it, we're saying that it's drudgery or that we should always outsource it or that we should be seeking only to enter the productive labor market. But, you know, I think I see the goal in measuring it and valuing it to really free men and women, to give them the choice to do it or to not do it. So the point is neither to paint this work as purely a burden or responsibility or to force women or men to do more or less of it, but really valuing it, is really the first step to thinking about how do we actually begin to give women and men the opportunity to choose whether they want to do more unpaid work or more paid work today.
And you're saying women or men. Traditionally, a lot of this has fallen more specifically on women, right? And as while things may be changing, as I understand it, they haven't changed to anywhere near a balance yet.
Right, absolutely. And just to kind of throw out a few numbers here, women are spending on average globally 4.5 hours a day on unpaid work. And of course, this varies widely by country and region. It won't surprise anybody, I don't think, that in India, women are spending far more time on unpaid work than they are in Norway. And in the U.S., you know, they may be spending 4.5 hours on laundry and cooking, and for women in Zimbabwe, she might be spending, more like 8 hours a day on gathering firewood and water for her family. But globally, women do spend at least double the amount of time that men spend on unpaid work, and that's according to the OECD. But, you know, the other interesting part of this, I think, is that this actually starts, this divide starts very early. So there was a study out of the University of Michigan that shows that American girls who are between the ages of 10 to 17 spend 2 hours more than boys on chores every week, and boys are 15% more likely to be paid for their chores. So it is something that is still disproportionately falling to women, and this really just does start at a very early age.
Talking to Elizabeth Weingarten with New America, talking about unpaid labor and the role it plays in the American economy and the global economy. One problem that you write about is how difficult it is to measure how much unpaid labor actually happens, and B, how little effort there's been to measure that unpaid labor. Why haven't we seen much of that?
Yeah, so it's an incredibly complicated thing to measure. In part, you know, what we were talking about before, it's really hard to agree on our definition of unpaid work. So, for instance, should volunteering be measured and compensated as part of unpaid work? Is it unpaid work when I wash my hair because I could technically pay someone else to do it? You know, I think this question of where do we draw the line and how do we measure this labor in a way that's both broad enough to take the diversity of unpaid labor into account, but specific enough so that it doesn't trivialize the biggest parts of what make up this ecosystem, you know, when we talk about kind of childcare and elder care. So that kind of definition part is really stymies, I think, economists and policymakers. The other problem is that one of the key ways that we've seen countries measure this around the world, which is through time use surveys. These are really tricky because, you know, as we all know, a lot of us are doing multiple things at one time. So if you're looking at, you know, if a government kind of puts out a survey that's attempting to measure how people spend their time during the day, say you are a guy and you're a freelancer, you stay at home for most of the day, and you're also taking care of your daughter. So you're writing and your daughter is playing and at the same time. So are you technically doing unpaid work right now? You know, how do you count that? That's another issue that people face when trying to kind of measure and quantify this. And the other piece of this that we were getting at earlier is this political pushback and folks who say that, you know, just by measuring it, we are kind of diminishing the value of this work and the fact that, it's not just drudgery. It's something that is some of the most joyful work that some of us will ever do. So, you know, does putting a number on it, does quantifying it take away from that? So these are all of the components, I think, that make it incredibly complicated to try to measure and value.
Okay, supposing we could and did measure it and have some pretty reliable numbers, what would we start doing with that information?
Yeah, so we do have some, you know, there are some numbers that are floating out there. I would be remiss if I didn't mention there was a fantastic McKinsey study that was done late last year showing that, you know, if unpaid work were calculated in GDP, its value would be about $10 trillion or, you know, about the size of China's GDP. Put another way, if women didn't carry most of the responsibility for unpaid work, which can often mean that they have to take part-time jobs or they have to take lower-paying jobs, global GDP would grow by $28 trillion, which is bigger than both the U.S. and Chinese economies combined. So if we were to have, you know, we already have some of those numbers, and we know just how kind of influential unpaid work is at a kind of global economic level. But having some of the more kind of granular numbers can make a huge difference in terms of kind of individual policies and programs that we're developing around the world. So, you know, there are many examples of this, but you know, if you look at say a program developed for job training in a particular part of the world for women, a program like that, if it completely ignores the fact that women are spending 8 hours a day on unpaid work, well, you're going to see really high dropout rates in that job training program. Maybe it's for women, micro entrepreneurs. Just by giving women a childcare stipend, you can completely change the way that they engage with that program and make it actually a good investment. But if you don't have that data, if you don't know how much time people are spending on those activities every day, your program isn't going to be as effective. And just at a very basic level, I think we hear this phrase a lot, what gets measured gets done. And if you're a policymaker, you're looking to data, you're looking to kind of evidence to show you that investing in a particular field or in infrastructure and in a program is the right thing to do. So if you don't know, well, women, you know, in this particular part of the world are spending X amount of time on this labor, how will you know that you should be investing in that as a policymaker?
We're talking to Elizabeth Weingarten with the think tank New America. She's written about the value of unpaid work in the American economy and the global economy. Things like caregiving, household work often done by women.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you spent a lot of your time doing this kind of unpaid work in your family? Do you think of it as work? Do you think it's undervalued in our society? And what questions do you have for our guest? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the economic impact of unpaid work. Think of family caregiving or household maintenance. Our guest is Elizabeth Weingarten, director of the Global Gender Parity Initiative and senior fellow in the Better Life Lab at New America.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you spent a lot of your life, a lot of your time doing this kind of unpaid labor? Do you think of it as unpaid labor when you do it, when you're taking care of kids or maybe an aging parent or maintaining the house? Do you think we take that kind of work seriously enough? Should we be accounting for it in our economy? Do you think it falls unfairly on women? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Elizabeth, how big an obstacle is this issue of unpaid work and not paying attention to unpaid work for gender parity as you work in the Global Gender Parity Initiative?
Oh, I think it's absolutely huge, and I think it's connected in so many ways to a lot of the other kind of quote-unquote gender parity issues that we think about when you think about women's ability to ascend in the workplace, for example, into leadership positions. The fact that we don't adequately count and measure unpaid work is, you know, directly, I think, translates into not having a federal paid leave policy. The fact that we don't have investments in child care, you know, these are the things that often hold women back from the kind of paid labor force, and not only from just the paid labor force, but from those kind of upper echelons of leadership in any industry across the country and the world. So it is deeply connected, I think, to all sorts of different areas where we're seeing gender inequality. Because when you have that inequality at home or kind of in the domestic sphere, that's the type of inequality that doesn't just stay domestic. It seeps out from there, and it impacts all different corners of somebody's life.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Chris is with us in Waukesha. Chris, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Chris?
Well, I am in my 50s, and I'm recently divorced after almost 30 years of marriage. I was had a very dynamic career when we got married and then stayed home to raise our son because of a lot of moving around with my ex-husband's career. And also cared for elderly parents and when they were getting ill. And when we went through the divorce, the consensus from my husband was that I didn't deserve anything because I never worked outside the home and never made any contribution financially to the household. And so I, of course, never looked upon my work that way. I valued it highly. It may have been because I came into it having worked in a career before I stayed home, I don't know, but when I always took the stance that my work was should be valued at the 50-50 contribution just because he was bringing the salary in, didn't change the way I looked at things.
Chris, thank you so much. I'm sorry for the rough time you had going through that. Elizabeth, I know you're working to collect stories about how unpaid labor has worked out. Here's a case where Chris saying her unpaid labor was unvalued in a very legal sense in this case.
Yeah, you know, and Chris, I am so sorry to hear that. And I think, you know, one of the solution areas that we look towards is, you know, how do we set up a system where you would get some kind of, you know, caregiver credits or, you know, how do we connect care to retirement or Social Security benefits? Because we do see that, you know, people who spend, you know, many years outside of the kind of productive or, you know, paid market are losing out on these, you know, these very real benefits, even though they're contributing in such a substantial way to the economy. So, you know, it's my hope that we see policies in the next few years that that acknowledge the key contribution that you're making as a caregiver to our entire economy, and that allow you to take advantage of some of the benefits that people in the paid economy or the paid market economy have.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Elizabeth Weingarten from New America about the role of unpaid labor in the economy, American economy and the global economy. Elizabeth, in some of what you've written about this, one of the biggest concerns you have is that nobody's writing about this. Nobody's talking about this, or almost no one. Why is this, do you think, an issue that's largely overlooked?
Yeah, so I think in part because, you know, you say the words unpaid work and people's eyes kind of glaze over. It's not a very exciting concept on its face. I mean, because, you know, when you talk about work, you know, it's not, talking about work isn't that exciting to begin with. I mean, some of us, of course, love our jobs, but just saying, I want to talk to you right now about work. Well, add unpaid work to that, and it's just not the most glamorous concept in the world. And then I think the fact that we all have so many different definitions for it and so many different ways that it affects our lives, it gets really hard to kind of construct a single or meaningful narrative around what it is and kind of what we should think or do about it, which is kind of good and bad. I mean, I think that makes it a really kind of robust and interesting topic. You know, one of the things that we argue in the piece is that unpaid work kind of has a branding problem. You know, not only do people not really know what it is, but people don't really seem to care or seem to connect it to kind of these bigger political, economic, social issues that it is kind of inextricably tied to. So we are actively looking for different ways to talk about it. So I think if any of your listeners have ideas for other ways to talk about unpaid work, just even other words to use, we're all ears for how to do that.
And Elizabeth, that makes me think you're partly looking for policy changes, maybe legal changes, changes in the kind of research that's being done. But fundamentally, this sounds like it would take a cultural change in the way we think about unpaid work or whatever we end up calling it.
Absolutely. I think you hit the nail on the head there, because we really can't have policy change without culture change, and particularly when you talk about some of these issues related to gender equality and gender inequality. And I think kind of a perfect example of that is paid leave. If you look at the companies across the country that have adopted paid leave, or even the cities and states that now have paid leave policies, you know, it only works if people kind of understand and see the value in taking that time. And particularly in companies, if there's been a culture shift to make people think that, oh, if I take paid leave, that, you know, it doesn't mean that my supervisor will think that I'm less committed to the job. But without that culture change, the policy doesn't really do much of anything. So I think you're absolutely right that we do need that kind of cultural change in rethinking how do we value this type of work. And I should say that the president and CEO of New America has been one of the most outspoken and articulate voices on this particular subject. And what she talks about is, you know, there are a lot of different ways that we can value and recognize this work, and it doesn't always have to be attached to money. So just saying to somebody, if you meet them, who says, you know, I'm a caregiver, responding to them and saying that is such important work, or, you know, just in the ways that we talk about this.
And we'll have to leave it there and maybe talk about it more in the future. Thanks to Elizabeth Weingarten with New America. You can find a link to some of her work on the concept of unpaid labor. There's a link at the Central Time Facebook page. Last weekend will be one that's remembered by Packers fans for Brett Favre's Hall of Fame induction and for the game that didn't happen because of poor field conditions in Canton, Ohio.
But today's date is even bigger in Packers history. According to the Wisconsin Historical Society, the Packers became a team on this day in 1919. Curly Lambeau and George Calhoun brought together a group of young athletes at the offices of the Green Bay Press Gazette to form the team.
They got sponsorship from the Indian Packing Company of Green Bay, which was soon taken over by the Acme Packing Company of Illinois. The packing company's sponsorship got the team its names. The rest, with some twists and turns, is Wisconsin and football history.
Sirius fans probably know all of this already, but as a bonus, we've linked to an article on 5 myths about the founding of the team. You can find that link on the Central Time Facebook page. I bet you're getting ready for the season, huh?
I am, yeah. Preseason opener was delayed a bit because of some faulty paint, apparently, on the field. That's one you don't hear every day.
No, it's not.
But, I mean, preseason, it's fun. The real season's the real deal. Yeah. That's what I'm really looking forward to. And, you know, fall weather, cooking out, all the classic
tailgating,
Packers traditions.
All the good stuff.
I haven't tailgated much lately. But
you can just do it in your driveway, Rob.
I could. Or my patio. All right, looking forward to Packers season. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.